This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
12 o'clock, and here we are, ladies and gentlemen, at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. We've got our helmets on, we've packed our panniers, and we are ready to go. Please welcome to the stage, in conversation with Julia Wheeler, Antonia Bullingbrook-Kent, and Lois Price.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this event, which is solo motorcycling, particularly for girls, but boys are very welcome too, so welcome along. Let's start with hearing about your journeys, because they are spectacular, both of them. Lois, begin. Where have you been?
My first long-distance journey was from Alaska to the bottom of South America. Are you hearing me all right?
Just pop it a bit closer. Bend it. Be brutal. That's it. Go.
Ah!
That's it.
Bit of teeth cleaning. Okay, how's that?
That's lovely.
Okay, so... Hello! So... In 2003, I had a boring job working at the BBC, and I decided to pack it in, and I rode a small motorcycle from Alaska to the bottom of Argentina, so to the very tip of South America. And then I came back from that, and all my friends and family thought, oh, I've got it out of my system, but of course it had completely the opposite effect. And so a couple of years later, I was riding from my home in London to Cape Town. Which was half the distance of the first journey and half the time, but 100 times tougher and exciting, really. And then I had a little break and did a few other trips with my husband, and then I did a solo ride around Iran, and I've been to Iran 3 times. And so those trips also make up the topics of my books.
Okay. Ants?
Well, my big travelling started about 12 years ago when my best friend rang me up one evening and said, do you want to drive a tuk-tuk with me from Bangkok to Brighton? So obviously I said yes, and we drove a tuk-tuk 12,500 miles and got the Guinness World Record for the longest ever journey by auto rickshaw, obviously something I dreamt of since school. After that, as Lois said, I was ruined. I could never go back to a normal life. I worked for a company called The Adventurist for a while, setting up adventures in Mongolia and Southeast Asia and Siberia. Did a few crazy trips by motorbike in Siberia in winter, minus 37 degrees, makes today look tropical. And then I decided that I had to travel alone. I decided that that's where the real excitement lay. I wanted to test myself. I wanted to see what I was really made of. And also, I think if you're writing, traveling alone is much better. You're much more immersed. So I did a solo journey down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia on an antiquated pink motorcycle. And then next, I spent 3 months exploring the Eastern Himalayas, Arunachal Pradesh, again alone, again on a cheap old motorbike I bought in India. So that's it in a nutshell.
you touched on, you know, obviously something I've been dreaming of since high school, but actually when you look back into your childhood, can you see that there were seeds sown there in terms of what you're now doing?
I think... I grew up in the North Norfolk countryside, and as a child, I was always outdoors. I was always climbing trees. I was always exploring the fields and woods, and I suppose the seeds were sown then. And also, when I was at school, I never wanted a normal job. I knew that whatever I was going to do, it had to involve being outside and travel.
Mm. What about you, Lois?
I like ants. I was always playing outside, climbing trees and messing about in rivers and building dams with my two brothers. And my parents were very kind of gung-ho outdoor types, and they certainly never differentiated between what my brothers should be doing, what I should be doing. We all did the same thing. We all wore the same clothes. I had all the hand-me-downs. So I think that gave me a taste for the outdoor life. But also, my parents never said, don't do that, it's dangerous, ever, about anything. And so when I was 13, me and 3 friends from school, all girls, went on a cycling trip together around Cornwall with no grown-ups. We just got our bicycles on the train down to Cornwall, and we just bicycled around Cornwall and just knocked on farmers' doors and said, can we sleep in your barn? And to think, I think nowadays, the idea of 4 13-year-old girls doing that with completely no adult supervision would be unthinkable, but that was maybe not normal, but it was normal in our family. And so I think that just gave me the, maybe somehow that gave me some kind of internal sense that this was possible, and it went from there, really. And I've always loved a road trip, and that sense of just moving every day and not knowing where you're going to sleep that night and waking up in a different place every day. So
let's get right to the crux. Is it more dangerous being a woman and travelling solo than it is being a man?
I think on the surface it would look that way, because women are seen as more vulnerable and worse things can happen to them, and you're technically probably weaker physically than most men. But the reality I found, and from speaking to other travellers, is that as a woman alone, it's actually very rare for people to view you as a target. And in fact, the natural human response to a female alone in a strange land is to look after them. And so that actually, that my experience has been the people respond in that way, and they're like, oh, are you okay? Or, you know, do you need to come in? Do you need anything? You know, you get offered to come back to the people's house, you get given food and tea. And that is a worldwide, universal response, human response to a woman alone, I think. So actually, in some ways, I think, you have to be sensible and practical look about things, but actually I don't think it is necessarily more dangerous.
Yeah, I would agree, definitely. I have always felt very sort of looked after when I'm travelling alone, particularly my last journey in northeast India, when I was staying with these different tribal peoples, and they'd be like, you're a woman travelling alone, you must stay in the next village, go and stay with my friend. I'd sort of be handed around like a doll at my break. And sometimes I'd almost be like, I don't need all this mollycoddling.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thin line, isn't there, between being patronised and being looked after.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't feel patronising. It felt just lovely and warm and caring. But I think, as Lois said, women travelling alone often seem to provoke that sort of almost maternal instinct in people. They want to look after you.
Yeah.
And I was saying this to you earlier, there's the first woman to motorcycle around the world was this French lady called Anne-France Dauphile, amazingly glamorous woman who did it in the early 70s. And she had this great quote when she had got a puncture in Afghanistan. She said, this truck stopped and three men got out, and one of them took her by the shoulders and made her sit down. Another one stood in front of her for shade, and the third one changed her tyre. And so she was sort of saying the solo woman is very protected. And I've had a few dicey experiences, but I've had much worse experiences in Bristol, where I live.
So tell us about some dicey experiences and how you've
maneuvered
your way out.
Not in Bristol.
I don't want to hear about Bristol.
I had a few dicey experiences on my trip down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I ran out of petrol, stupid thing. My family always all run out of petrol, bad family trait. In the middle of the jungle, and in the way that often happens when you travel alone, you haven't seen anyone for hours or a day, and then someone suddenly appears to help you when you most need it. And these two chaps stopped and agreed to help me, but while they're helping me, one of them kind of went like that. But it was funny because I didn't feel, instinct. We've talked about this more, but instinct's such a thing when you travel alone. And I didn't actually feel that he was going to do anything awful. I just felt that he was trying it on. So I just removed his hand and gave him a stern talking to and said, right, back to the petrol now. And they were like, oh, sorry, And then when I had to stay in a brothel a few times on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, because it was the only place to stay, I think that confused people. They tried to get into my room, but opened the door, to make it very clear that you're not, for rent, and they go away.
So if there hadn't been anywhere else to stay for a man, presumably he potentially wouldn't have been able to stay in the brothel. So actually, in that situation, it was probably helpful being a woman.
Well,
I'm speculating here, but...
Possibly, yeah. Maybe.
Maybe. let's
depends
leave that
what's
there.
On the menu, I guess.
So...
I can imagine, though, that there are advantages, actually, in terms of the travel that you experience being a woman, because you are less of a threat to other women than
perhaps
if it was a man.
I think a woman alone is never seen as a threat in any situation in life. So, therefore, people are immediately more willing to invite you into situations, and certain situations where they might not feel that comfortable with inviting a single man or even a group of men or two men together. so like a family situation. I think you end up being invited more into kind of family homes than you might do if you're, you know, a bunch of big guys on big motorbikes. It might be a bit of an intimidating look. And I remember a guy who rode across Iran telling me he had a fantastic time, as everyone does who goes to Iran, but that he really, his only socialising was with other men, because it would be unlikely for an Iranian woman or family to kind of say, come in and, you know, hang out with the girls, you know. So, especially in Islamic countries, where the socialising is often quite separated. But as a woman, you'll be invited into group situations and women-only situations. Well, as a guy, you obviously wouldn't mingle so much with the women. So you sort of see a different side of the society. Not necessarily better or worse, but just, I think, you get maybe more of an overview as a woman.
And that must be so helpful when you're then going on to write the books,
absolutely,
particularly in a place like Iran.
Yes, because you need to see that overview, and you want to see all different ends of society as well. And I think that was one thing in Iran, that there's such a culture of hospitality in Iran that, and it extends not just from, you know, you've got your kind of English speaking elite or metropolitan elite type Tehranis who will be very welcoming, invite you in to everything, take you to parties and all the rest of it, but equally you can be right out in the sticks and some, you know, shepherd will like take you in for the night, so you get every single possible hospitality experience in Iran, and that's what makes it such a rich country to travel in.
And what did the Iranian women think about you?
Well, they were all up for it, you know. Everywhere in the world, I've noticed that. You must have got this as well. Your presence, arriving maybe in a small village or something, it invokes a kind of response from women, and they're kind of punching the air, even like old ladies with the chador. They're like, very brave, well done, you know. And they kind of see you as an ally, like you're doing something for the greater womanhood of the world, you know. And they often, you know, I remember in South America, kind of really old ladies in Bolivia sort of going, muy brave, you know, very brave, and really kind of rooting for you.
Yeah.
It's really sweet. But you get the same response from the guys, but I think the women relate to it a lot more, because they're often much more restricted in their lives. So it makes them feel good to see someone else doing something like that, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, Ant, you graduated from three wheels on a tuk-tuk to two wheels. What is it that you love about travelling by motorcycle?
Oh, the sense of freedom. I mean, the literal sort of visceral feeling of the wind in your face, being able to smell everything and feel everything, that you feel much more connected to the landscape you're driving through, to people. People, I think, if you arrive in a tiny village in the middle of Arunachal Pradesh and a big 4x4, well, you probably couldn't even get a 4x4 there anyway, you're sort of the other, you know, you're a big, rich foreigner in this glass and steel case. But on a motorbike, especially a small, cheap one you've bought there, I think you're much more accessible. People can instantly relate to you more. Plus, motorbikes are much cheaper. They're cheap, easier to fix. They're just more fun. Once you start travelling by motorbike, there's no going back.
So you do. I can completely get that you're part of the landscape, but there is, again, some vulnerability there, isn't there? It's not like you can, you know, if you can't find a place to sleep, you could potentially sleep in a car or a four-wheel drive or whatever else. And, you know, people are right up to you, which is wonderful, but there is that vulnerability.
Yeah, but I suppose that's... I don't really... I mean, of course, when you're riding a motorbike, you're always aware of the risks, but that again is whether you're in Bristol or whether you're in, you know, Tibet, could be anywhere. But you just have to, you know, be aware, vaguely aware of that, and not let it ruin the.
Yeah, but I think you embrace the vulnerability.
Yeah.
That's what actually makes the experience richer. That you are engaging with every sense, every smell, you get it right, you know, you get the rain, you get the cold, you get the sun, the wind, the butterflies, whatever's going on, and the people, and you can't escape it, so you have to embrace it. And people are coming out and tugging your clothes and beeping your horn, and so I think if that is unnerving to you, then it's probably motorcycling isn't the best form of travel, because there is nowhere to hide. You know, like you say, you can't just press the windows of the car and they just lock yourself in. But especially if you're writing about it, I think you want to be that vulnerable, really, and just accept that vulnerability and just go with it, really.
It's much more exhilarating.
It is, yeah, exactly. I mean, you get the same on a bicycle as well, I think. Just anything that you're literally exposed to, everything around you.
Mm-hmm.
But motorbikes are more fun, obviously, yeah. than bicycling.
And less hard work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, better for the hills.
Yeah.
So tell us about your bikes then, Lewis.
So all of my trips have been on small trail bikes or dirt bikes, essentially, because for me, I like to be able to go off the tarmac and down dirt tracks and explore a little bit into the wilderness. But I'm quite short, 5'4", and I was travelling alone on all my trips, so it was really important for me that I could pick my bike up, that it was quite light and that I could touch the ground, because a lot of bikes like that are quite tall and big. And the way that motorcycles are targeted for adventures are these massive, huge kind of bikes like Ewan McGregor rode on his journey. Mm. But actually, they're not really the most practical because they're complicated mechanically. So if you're in the middle of a bush, you can't get them fixed because you need a computer to plug into them. So I tried to keep everything really, really light, really small, really simple, so I can fix it myself or a bush mechanic can fix it. That's really the kind of rule. And, and I have to physically be able to pick it up. And if it falls on top of me, you know, I'm not going to be squashed under it. So all of my bikes have been 250cc trail bikes, a Yamaha. They've all been Yamahas, actually, and now I've got a Honda. But they're all very much of a similar type, yeah. And people say, oh, they're really small, but the top speed, I'm really comfortable going 50 miles an hour. And once you get out of the developed world, the kind of roads that you're riding on, you know, full of potholes and there's kids and donkeys and dogs running around everywhere, and obviously you're on dirt roads a lot, it's almost a waste to have a big, powerful, fancy bike because you can't really put it to any use. And actually, I quite like pootling along slowly, really. So I'm kind of
happy. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be rushing through.
No,
because
you miss out. You really do miss a lot. And Ants is right in what she says about blending in. And so if you're using like a local bike or a small bike of your own that looks a bit kind of scruffy and low key, it's much easier then to connect with people when you meet them than turning up on like a massive flashy thing that costs 20,000 quid. You're immediately creating that division between you and the people in that country. So so I'm all for like lo-fi, scruffy.
Good. What about you, Anne?
I'm very much the same, although I suppose I take a slightly different approach because I generally go to the place where I'm going to do the journey and then buy the bike there and find a bike that is... I was going to say indigenous to the region. So when I did the Ho Chi Minh Trail, I bought a Honda Cub in Hanoi. It was $200 or something. It was 25 years old. I got it serviced and done up a bit. And my reasoning was that Honda Cubs are supposedly indestructible. I mean, this is a 90cc. It's tiny, for those of you who don't know what a Honda Cub is.
It's like a pizza bike.
It's a pizza delivery bike. Yeah, it's not designed for 2,000-mile journeys through mud and mountains.
And actually, I don't know whether you have the same situation, but on your northeast India trip, you kind of had a top box on, which was a bit pizza delivery as well,
yes, which I got made in India, which rattled terribly all the time, yes. So the Honda Cub, really simple to fix, indestructible, and the mechanics there would know what they were doing if I couldn't fix it. And in India, I bought a bike for 300 quid. It was an Indian make called a Hero, and it was amazing. And again, people could fix it. It was small, it was light, I could pick it up. All my kit was secondhand, cheap, nothing fancy or expensive. I've never spent more than £300 on a motorbike.
So you must trust yourself to know enough mechanically to identify a decent bike that's going to get you from A to B and possibly to C, and to know what you're doing. I mean, how much mechanical knowledge do you both have?
I have a Haynes manual. and I do have a basic kit, and I know a little bit, but you know, I'm really, really not. I mean, really, if you are thinking you're going on a journey and you think I can't go because I don't know about mechanics, don't let that stop you.
No, definitely not.
Because there's always someone to help if you can't do it. I'm not a mechanic.
I started out motorcycling on old vintage British bikes, which are renowned for falling to bits all the time. So I was just riding around London. I never went outside of the M25, really, but even that, I would break down, you know, almost every time I went somewhere. So I became adept at sort of, you know, hearing the clink of something falling off, stopping, fixing it, you know, on the way. And so I was sort of had an overview of that kind of thing anyway. And then I did, my friend taught me some mechanics as well before I went. So I suppose I feel okay about replacing things that wear out, that kind of stuff. I wouldn't take an engine apart and rebuild an engine, but I would certainly like replace brake pads or a chain and sprocket. I've done, you know, all that kind of thing, oil filters. And so because my first journey was 10 months, you know, there was, you couldn't really go that long, honestly, because my bike was old and secondhand when I set off. So I knew there would be a certain amount of maintenance that I would need to do. And I think also there's something about, and this is something that I think women aren't really exposed to much in everyday life when we're young, but something about understanding how it works, even if you don't know how to fix it, but understanding what the parts are called, how they work together, what that does, and if that's making funny noise, what could it mean? Even if it's just knowing the names of the parts, so you can go into a mechanic and say, oh, you know, my sprocket's worn out, and you can have an educated conversation with somebody. I think that just gives you, you know, knowledge is power, that kind of idea. So even if you can't actually, like, rebuild the bike yourself, you can at least get it sorted with confidence.
A lot of mechanics, especially with something really basic like a Honda Cub, isn't rocket science.
No,
a lot of it
exactly.
is common sense.
Super logical.
And literally with a Haynes manual, and as you said, knowing your way around the engine, you can do a lot of stuff. But I think women particularly can be very bad at just being like, I can't do that. Rather than, I mean, like my boyfriend, you know, he's not a mechanic, but he will quite happily just take apart a motorbike engine and put it back together just because of the attitude.
Yeah.
Of like, well, why couldn't I do it?
And that's inbred from very early on.
Yeah.
Because my brother didn't even drive a car until he was about 30-something. But I got my first car and there was something wrong with it, and I opened up the bonnet and I didn't know what I was looking at. You know, I was like 20 years old or something. And he said, oh, it'll be the spark plugs. And he started, I didn't even know what a spark plug was or where they would be, but somehow my brother knew this. Like, how do you even know that? You know, you don't even drive. But there's something that happened, I don't know, you're just exposed to this language and attitude, like you say, a kind of can-do attitude. And I think it is quite hard for women to get into that mindset. So,
which is why I think these
self-reliance.
Journeys... Yeah.
Yeah.
So good for you. Why I think travelling alone particularly is so good for you, because it makes you try things.
Yeah.
It makes you do things which you think normally you wouldn't do. So if I go on a long trip with my boyfriend, he's so much better than all these things. So I just sit back, have a gin and tonic, have a bag, let him do it. Whereas, you know, when you're on your own, you have to. You haven't got someone else's strengths to hide behind. So it's a really... And Dervla Murphy's got this great quote. I'm sure you all know Dervla Murphy. That she said, it's amazing what latent talents you discover when you break down alone mid-desert.
Exactly.
It's so true. You're on your own. Something goes wrong. You have to fix it.
Well, it's necessity is the mother of invention, but also the mother of just getting on with it. And then you've got no choice. Mm. So it is amazing what you can dig deep and find. Yeah.
So we've talked... bikes. What about the rest of the kit in terms of what you're wearing and what you've got in that top box or in your panniers or wherever? What is essential then? What wouldn't you leave home without?
Leopard print?
Leopard print underwear?
Yes.
The more I travel, the less I take. That is the crucial thing. You know, the first trip, I had this enormous list that I'd probably, you know, got from somewhere, and I was busying around getting everything and then getting spares of everything in case things broke. You know. And after about the first months on the road, I'm literally weighed down by this stuff. It's a liability, it's more stuff to worry about, and you realise that actually all the stuff you need is out there in the world anywhere. You're not going into such remote, well, probably not, you know, unless you're doing some extreme Saharan expedition. You are travelling on roads where there are people and people living, and they all need things like shampoo and, you know, I don't know what else, just everyday stuff, socks, you know, so you don't have to bring everything from home. And I think that was a big lesson for me, and now I know that I can only leave, you know, I can leave with the very, very basic stuff. So there's certain tools that I wouldn't leave without that are specific to my bike. And for me, the huge big kind of turnaround has been the Kindle, because I live in fear of running out of books. So I used to fill my pannier with mat load of books, and I was always hunting for the next English language book, you know. And so the Kindle has totally liberated my panniers. Yeah, it's been really good.
Yeah, same. Traveling light is so important. And again, my kit's always been, I've always taken small cloth secondhand panniers I bought on eBay for like 30 quid. And the most important thing is the toolkit. I always have a waterproof top box for your camera, your toolkit, and take like literally two pairs of pants, two pairs of socks, travel as light as possible. Lucky teddy bear.
Of course. But that is liberating, living like that for a while, actually.
Oh, so great.
Because we're so bogged down with stuff.
Yeah, but does that translate in your real life when you
get
back?
No, I've got loads of handbags and shoes at home and everything, but I'm happy to sort of be different on the road. You know, I don't need all of that stuff around me. No, I've got a massive record collection, loads of books. I'm not a minimalist at home, you know, but I just, it is freeing to the mind to just like have a very, very small amount of stuff to think about, because everything you own, it's something to worry about. And I never travel with expensive electronics or anything like that. I don't take a laptop or GPS, because I just want that lo-fi simplicity. That I find that really, really
except the Kindle.
Except for the Kindle, that's the one bit. Yeah,
I take Kindle as well.
Yeah.
And what about GPS and maps? Are you paper? Are you digital?
I'm both. I always get the best maps there are. But I mean, the last trip I did in Arunachal Pradesh, like, they're just a no good maps. Mm. So even the wonderful Stanford, the shops, the maps they had available in Northeast India, they didn't. You know, there's no one's done any detailed maps. So I actually use an offline mapping app called Galileo, which is incredibly helpful. But again, basically it was just a blue dot and a big blank area, because there was no proper roads and just forests there. So mapping can be quite a challenge. But you're much better at navigation than me.
Well,
I've got an awful sense of direction. I get lost all the time.
I don't think I'm a particularly good map reader or navigator, but I love maps. I love paper maps. So I get excited about maps. I buy them just for fun and somewhere I'd like to go. And I love the overview you get from a paper map, because then you start seeing, oh, there's an interesting looking lake up there, or what's that bit of forest here? So I think that they fire the imagination. But I had the same problem in Iran as you had in India, is that the maps are really poor of Iran. I think just years of kind of Anglo-Iranian relations have meant that we haven't really done very good mapping over there. So I would just get lost all the time in Iran. I mean, all the time. More than anywhere else that I've ever been, I was always getting lost. Because the signs are either all in Persian or there's no signs at all. And so I think the instinct is to start panicking as soon as you get lost. And then I would have to sort of talk myself down and realise, actually, getting lost is really part of the fun, because that's when you end up going somewhere you didn't expect. You discover something, you ask someone for directions, and then, of course, it's, oh, I'll come back to my place, you know. So that's where all the fun bits happen. So it can be frustrating and worrying at times, but I always carry a compass and paper map. But, I mean, nowadays, you know, if you've got your phone, obviously you can get Google Maps, but like Anne says, sometimes it just doesn't, you know, in Iran I had no phone signal anyway, so just relying on, excuse me, you know, how do you, pointing at that bit, and then...
And actually women are better at that, aren't they?
Oh, I do. I love it. I love asking directions. Yeah, because it's something funny always happens.
God, I was getting in Laos when I was following the Ho Chi Minh Trail, I got lost in the jungle the whole time. There was lots of UXO, unexploded ordnance, left over from the Vietnam War there. So you'd get lost and I'd have to turn around. But I'd have to do like a 25-point turn, because there might be UXO in the jungle. So that gave a whole new meaning to getting lost.
Yeah, I had the similar thing in Angola. Yeah, I got lost and stuck in a minefield. So look, but we're both here with both our legs intact.
only this one.
So you've touched on it, the idea of planning versus spontaneity, and also I know you're both big believers in kind of letting the universe take its course, letting the universe come to you, but that involves quite it's an open mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is my opinion, don't overplan an adventure. I mean, like my last trip, I knew I had 2.5 months. I knew there were areas, because of the permits, I only had limited time. I knew there were specific areas I wanted to go. But I certainly wasn't like, well, I'm going to be here tonight, here tonight, here tonight. Because things happen. Like, you know, suddenly someone said, oh, my tribe are holding a 5-day shamanic gathering for the next 5 days up in the mountains. Come. Mm. And if you're on a, well, I've got to be there by February the 2nd, then you're going to miss out on all these great things.
Mm. So, and that did happen. Tell us about the shamans.
Oh, God. Yes, 5 days of widespread animal sacrifice in a tiny village in the mountains, and I'm a vegetarian.
So yeah. It was so clearly worth making the detour.
But it was an amazing experience, apart from the animal sacrifice. And things like that always happen on these trips, don't
they? Yeah, absolutely. And you've got to be ready to just go. And yeah.
That's not an adventure. You know, I think a lot of what these journeys are about is it's about letting go. You know, in our daily lives, we're so regimented and organised and planned and held in. And you just want to embrace the unknown and let go. Yeah. And that's what adventure's about.
I think setting a departure date is important, because you could talk yourself out of it for ages. But if you tell everyone you're going on this day, then you have to go, you know. But you don't really want to set an end date if possible. And say my America's trip, I estimated I'd be away about 8 months. So I ended up being away 10 and going to countries that I hadn't expected to go to and all that stuff. So it's really hard finding that middle ground between planning effectively so you're not a complete it's not a total cock up and you turn up at a board and you haven't got the visa and you're like, oh, I was just winging it. You know, you do have to kind of know enough to make it happen effectively, and say prepare your bike so it's not just going to break down, you know, by the time you get to Portsmouth or whatever. So, but then you don't want to over plan and do what like Ant says and just have this kind of schedule and feel locked into that. So it's knowing kind of when, especially if you're a list writing type of person like I am. I kind of the tendency is to like, okay, I want to make everything just so.
Yep.
And it takes me, I'd say, about 2 weeks to let that feeling fully go.
Yep.
And stop trying to control every aspect of your trip. And what am I going to eat today? And when am I going to stay? And where am I going to stay? And then after about 2 weeks, you just think, oh, it's like this physical relief. You're like, I don't care when I next have a shower. I'll work something out. You know. And then suddenly you're like freed from all of these expectations you put on yourself.
It's almost like getting over jet lag. Just kind of place lag. You've just got to ease
yourself into that attitude. And you enjoy the trip much more once you get like that. But it's, for me, it's a definite stage of the journey.
Well, I think it's part of, I think at the beginning of a journey, and this, you know, however much I travel and do these journeys, I still...
Yeah, me too.
There's a lot of fear at the beginning.
You're
going into this very vulnerable state, you don't know what's going to happen, and I think your fear can manifest as trying to control it. You know, I'm going to be here tomorrow, and then, as Lois said, it's always a few weeks in, you just let go. The fear goes, and then your control goes, and then you're just in it. Mm. You know, you're living the adventure. Mm.
And how much do you keep in touch with people back home so that, I mean, as much for their sake as for yours, and how much do you actually think, I don't want to WhatsApp you 3 times a day because actually that's not part of my solo travel experience?
Well, on my first journey was 2003. There was no social media. Email had been invented, but it wasn't easily accessible. You had to find an internet cafe. You remember those things? And, you know, when you're in El Salvador or something, that doesn't happen very often. Maybe in the big cities there'll be one or two. So the expectation wasn't there so much then, really. And I've never carried a phone on my trips. And in Africa, again, in a similar situation, internet cafes, but they're so unreliable, you know, there'd be power cuts, the internet would go down. So, and the only way you could phone home would be these guys would be out in the street with little tables and mobile phones on them, and you went and paid them and said, I want to ring England. So I might do that whenever I saw that, really, but it wasn't like a regular, oh, I need to phone home every week. You know, my mum's fine, you know, she knows I'll be all right. So I'd phone my husband as much as I could, but it wasn't like I was at the end of a mobile phone and I was seeing all my friends' posts or anything like that. And I like to escape that, really. And in Iran, I couldn't get on the internet and phone signal anyway, so again, it was only if I could get on a computer somewhere, which wasn't very common. And so much stuff is blocked in Iran anyway, the internet is massively controlled. So I couldn't go on Facebook and just scroll through everybody's posts. So, and actually, it's really nice to not be doing that the whole time. So, no, I think cutting yourself off a little bit is part of the experience.
Do you do that too?
I do take a phone, but I try... I definitely don't promise anyone I'll ring them all the time. I mean, my boyfriend, I do try and call him when I can to say that I'm still alive. But my last trip, there was one time when for 2 weeks there was absolutely no telephone reception whatsoever. So I just said, you're not going to hear from me for a while. But I think personally, I think it's a bad thing to take a phone and get into. You've got to do an Instagram post every day and Facebook, because then you're not cutting yourself off and you're, you know, posting and looking, have I got how many likes, and
that's just not
what it's all about.
But
do you get lonely?
No. I've only felt I can only remember feeling lonely once. I remember it because it was, I was like, this is so weird, I'm feeling lonely, because normally I feel so stimulated by what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing. I think also when you know you're writing a book, you're constantly really engaging and looking and writing notes, and you're on a real mission. It's just so exciting. So weirdly, I don't get lonely.
So when you were lonely that time, what did you do about it?
I made a video diary and told my camera I was lonely. It's like, this is really weird, I'm lonely, and I wrote my diary, and then I was fine the next day. It was just I think I had a cold and I was feeling a bit ill, but yeah.
What about you, Lois?
No, I don't feel like I've ever felt lonely as in I wish I had company, because actually it's quite a sociable way of travelling. And that's the other thing you asked about motorcycling, the benefits of why motorcycling. The other part side of motorcycling, which I think you don't get with other forms of transport, is there's an enormous worldwide camaraderie. So if you want to connect with other motorcyclists, you can, or you often meet up with them on the road, that kind of thing. So, and really, it's quite, you often find you're hardly ever alone. I mean, you're alone when you're sitting on the bike, but I'm always thinking and writing in my head anyway. And like Ant says, you're constantly stimulated. So I think loneliness is probably more an issue if you, I don't know, maybe living in a foreign country for a long time alone and kind of working, going home every night and sort of sitting at home. But when you're on the road, I mean, it's just, every time you stop, there's people to talk to and hang out with, and, you know. So in a way, it's actually quite a good, if you're an extrovert, I think you can go and have like really good party time.
I'd say the place,
I miss people though. I miss home and people at home. But I don't sort of feel lonely. And also, I love to read. And if I've got a book, I'm just in heaven, you know.
But, I mean, the last two trips I've been on, that I never saw other foreigners at all. One on each journey. There weren't other people, so I was very much on my own. But I didn't feel lonely because it was so exciting.
Great. Mm. Wonderful. Right, let's get the microphone out, if we may. If you've got a question for Lois or Ant, do stick up your hand. Did you have a question? No. Well, it's like an auction, isn't it? You've just bid for one. Let's go here.
Hello. It's my question for Lois. You've been to Iran, right? How did you find the dress code there? Did you have to dress differently?
Yes.
With your leopard skin pants, etc. Did you need something else on your head?
Sorry?
Did you need something on your head?
Yeah. So the question was about the dress code in Iran for women. So, yeah, by law in Iran, you have to cover your hair. And cover, well, everything apart from your face and your hands is actually how they define it. So one of the ways that manifests itself is wearing a headscarf the whole time. So I would, obviously, when I had my helmet on, I'd be fine. I'd have my hair tucked into my helmet. But then there was always that, like, awkward moment of when you stop, take the helmet off, and you've got to have the headscarf on, ready to whip out, you know. So I got it down to a fine art, having it in my pocket and quickly do the thing, you know. And then the other thing you have to wear in Iran is because women's hips and bums are apparently just too much to bear. You have to cover that, cover them up. So you wear this thing called a manteau, like the French word for coat. It's like a shirt dress, really. And you see a lot of Iranian women wearing them over, like, skinny jeans or whatever. So I would wear, I had a really weird look, basically, because I had my motorcycle boots, jeans, and then this kind of shirt dress thing, and then my motorcycle jacket, and then either my helmet or my scarf. So, yeah, it wasn't my best sartorial moment, but it was. It's interesting, because in Iran, everyone wants to talk to you about that. Everyone asks you what you think about wearing a headscarf, about hair, and most people are against it in Iran. But it is a pain, but you do get used to it. And of course, then there's no bad hair days as well. So, yeah.
Other questions?
Another question about Iran. How do you get around the visa restrictions for independent travel?
Yeah, that's a good question, because at the moment, so this is a question about the visas at the moment for British passport holders, you mean, yeah. My first two trips I went were 2013 and early 2014, and then that was before they changed the rules and British people were allowed to travel independently. They actually changed the rules while I was there in April, and now British passport holders can't travel without a guide or part of a tour, and that is just absolutely no way around that, unfortunately.
Get an Irish passport.
Yeah. Become a European. Civilise Europe.
There are so many reasons to
do
that.
Exactly. Yeah. We are European. But it's the same. If American, Canadian and English all have the same restriction. I mean, it's all to do with the politics going back, you know, 100 years, really. And we're the ones that suffer. But Iranian visa regulations do have a history of just changing for no reason whenever. So just hang on in there. But even to go with a tour would be worth it because it's such a wonderful place.
Well, there might be an exciting tour.
There might be, mightn't there?
Yes, later this year.
I hope so.
Other questions? Come on, bikers, you must have questions.
Who is a biker here? Hands up, who's a biker? Okay, a bit of a mixture, good, okay.
You had a question down here. Oh, sorry, we'll come to you in a second. Let's go ahead.
Hiya, yeah.
Hello.
What about red tape associated with crossing the borders with the bike? Was that difficult? In the past, you had to put up customs money and things like that, or has that all gone away nowadays?
So are you asking about crossing international borders with a motorcycle?
Yeah.
Well, I think, like Anne's saying about buying a bike in country makes a lot of sense if you're staying in one country. It's probably easier to do that than bringing your own bike and all the other advantages of it. But if you are wanting to do a big transcontinental thing like the Americas, is 14, 15 countries, that particular route is really quite straightforward. You just have all your documents and an international driving license, and you get stamped in and out of the border. You stamp your bike into your passport, and then when you leave the country, you stamp it out again, and that's it. Other parts of the world are much more complicated, and you have to get a special documentation. So Africa, certain parts of Asia. It's all doable, but it becomes expensive and hassly. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of people, for their first trip, a long-distance trip, they tend to do the Americas, because it's very, very simple, and it's visa-free as well if you're European or British. So, yeah.
I guess, Ant, you had a situation more probably with the tuk-tuk going across borders, did you?
I mean, yeah, that was 12 years ago, and I think a lot of things have changed. Again, we weren't going through any countries that had a carné, so... it was just having the right paperwork, and then every border we just had to buy new insurance and fill in lots of forms. It wasn't as difficult as you'd think. It just took quite a lot of planning.
Yeah, it's just faffing around, but it's worth the trouble, isn't it? I think.
Question here, yeah.
Do you have any trips coming up? Anything planned or in the pipeline?
So future trips.
Future trips. I haven't got a big looming motorcycle adventure. I've just come back from a road trip around Jamaica. But if I was going to do another long distance motorcycle journey, I'd love to ride around Japan, actually, because that really fascinates me, and I've never been there, so that would be my top choice. So that'll happen one day, I'm sure.
And there wouldn't be any visa restrictions crossing over there.
Who knows?
I don't have any big ones. I run a travel company now called Silk Road Adventures, and we're going off to lead a couple of motorcycle trips in Jordan in March, and I'm really into rock climbing now, so I'm going to do some rock climbing in Jordan. So I'm dreaming of another big trip, but nothing is in the bag yet.
So if people were thinking of going to Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and in that area, how's motorcycling there?
Well, Tajikistan particularly, the motorcycling is some of the best adventure biking in the world. It's absolutely amazing. Uzbekistan, you have to go very slowly, which is quite boring, but it's still amazing. Central Asia is a great place for biking, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're dropping all the visas. It's very easy to go to. Mm. Yeah, highly recommended.
Fantastic. Well, if you want to carry on the conversation, do go and see Lois and Ants over
at
the Stanford's
come and ask us anything,
travel bookstore over there. Go and have a flick through the book. You've been all over, so I'm not even going to repeat, but I mean, we've covered Africa, we've covered Asia, we've covered Iran, we've covered the Americas, so there is something for everybody.
Sure.
Thank you very much for coming, bikers, women, men, everybody. Thanks for great questions. Ants, Lois, thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Come and ask us anything over there.
Thank you.